Hi, this is Kenneth Nguyen. A few years ago, before I launched the Vietnamese podcast, my father and all of his siblings passed away. Their passing marked the loss of their stories and the connection to my grandparents and great-grandparents. This is partly what inspired me to start the work of the podcast. Many of you still have the opportunity to record and preserve the legacies of your own families. I've just begun to sit with a few families now for interview sessions to record the rich histories of their parents and the lives of the generations that preceded them. Don't let your family's stories go untold. Take a moment to reach out to me, and together we will bring out your family's story on a recorded journey. I've included the link in the episode description. Visit VietnamStoryBank.com today for more information.
Welcome to Sea Dreams, the Southeast Asia Dreams podcast, where we talk about all things Southeast Asia. I am Kenneth Nguyen, and I'm my co-host On Vo today. We are missing Phil Van, but in place of Phil Van today, we have two of our guests. We have a recurring guest, Shep Nguyen Bui, and we have one of our dear friends, Benny Tran. Benny Tran is a world traveler, and he's been to a lot of places. He's eaten at a lot of restaurants, and he's put a lot of miles on the world. And so we wanted to put these guys together, and we want to talk about
the national issues of Southeast Asia.
Yeah, and we're here to really figure out what is the best. I mean, these are fighting words, but we're just here to discuss all the dishes of Southeast Asia. And we really want to talk about the variety and what stands out, and perhaps which one is number one, maybe.
Well, I think first off, we need to discuss why these two. We've chosen these two bloods.
Well, it takes two to substitute one Phil.
Yeah. It takes two guys to substitute one Phil. But Chef Nguyen Bui has been on the podcast before, and Chef Nguyen knows a lot about food, obviously, and he's eaten at a lot of places and knows a lot of food. Benny.
And so he's giving us the chef side or the preparation side, right? The restaurant side of things, right?
Yes. And Benny has actually been on the practical application side. He's been to a lot of the restaurants in Southeast Asia. He's spent probably over a decade in Southeast Asia traveling around and eating at a lot of restaurants in Southeast Asia.
And street foods and
street foods, yeah. So he's very qualified to talk about it. And we do recognize that there's four Vietnamese guys here talking about Southeast Asian food.
So maybe a little biased.
A little biased, but we're going to try to not be. We're going to try to really, you know, move beyond that bias.
So we should reference first where we come from. So from Vietnam's perspective, what's the national dish of Vietnam, Ken?
Well, I think Vietnam is known all over the world for pho and banh mi, right? That's the two things that we're really, really known for, pho and banh mi. And then most recently, Buc Cha Hanoi. When Bourdain and Obama made it really blow up, right? Those three dishes are, you know, I love to eat those dishes. But I think that you have a problem with saying pho is our best dish.
What's our official national dish is pho, right? Is there official?
Is it? I don't think there's anything that's official, but I think it's quite well recognized. Now, from my perspective, there's two ways to look at this discussion, right? One is, what are outsiders' perspectives of what is the national dish of a country or nation, and what the people themselves within that nation consider the national dish. And I think there's a difference between the selection of these dishes.
Right. And it also is a vessel for really a country to express itself. And sometimes the country adopts what's popular to express itself in the continuation thereof, right? But there's other people, like in Thailand, does claim their national dish to be Pad Thai. And that's pretty common as well. But yeah, I mean, we talk about national dishes, but also kind of the taste profiles of each country is going to be pretty interesting to really dive into.
Yeah. And what kind of criteria are we, I mean, it's not judging, but what are we kind of basing some metric on?
If we were to ask what is the best dish? Well, deliciousness is too difficult to nail down. But there are some other things that you can judge dishes on, like longevity in popularity. You can judge them on, like, for example, I think pho is the best dish. We'll just cut to the chase. And
I'm anxious, sir.
And the reason why is because if it's one of its popularity, it's obviously delicious. But what's unique about pho is it's that you can eat it anytime. And of there's very few dishes that breakfast, lunch, dinner, late at night, snack, where the dish makes sense. And I think that's what's makes pho so common.
But what's interesting is pho in Vietnam is under the breakfast dish, right? It's accessible.
It's not known, or it is known.
From what I understand, it's known to be a breakfast dish. And what pho is known in Vietnam is more of a home-based dish, a specialty dish, or home-based dish. And yes, there has been a sprouting of all these restaurants that sell pho, but it's no different than any other dish or specialty restaurants. Because what's interesting about Vietnam is that you have, one, it's the commerce is set up based on the old French style, which is the value of your property is due to the width of what you have in the main street. And that's why you have a lot of vertical housing in Vietnam.
Narrow and deep. Narrow and deep.
Narrow and deep, right? Because it's really based on the value of the houses was
the front deep.
Originally the frontage. And then you have all these businesses there, right? But I think, which is also very interesting about Southeast Asia, you know, I've been traveling in Europe, I've been to the Middle East, to Africa, and there's one is commerce is buzzing. There's a lot of people in Southeast Asia, but also there's a lot of street food. There's a lot of business that happens and commerce that happens on the streets, which includes food. And so when you have, you looked at, aside from the chains that exist now, right? You have tons of different business that serve one dish for each business, right? That's mostly they specialize in something, they serve one dish. If it's bún mào, if it's pho, if it's the pie salad. But then you go to the bigger restaurants, which is, I think, a later emergence of food in Vietnam or the restaurant a concept. And there's a whole history of restaurants and dining, right? That I think I talked about before. They specialize in certain things. So meaning there's a specialty pho restaurant, there's a specialty hutia restaurant, there's a specialty, crab curry restaurant. So, it's pretty common to have everything. That pho has just emerged to be a big thing. But what I understand was it's a breakfast food.
Now they eat it all the time.
They do.
And then around the world, they eat it all the time.
Around the world, for sure. I think that's why it's the beauty of pho becoming a very omnipresent dish for the Vietnamese cuisine.
All right, I think we're done with the episode, right?
No,
we're done?
No, one more thing. I think, can you talk about, and then I think this will echo throughout the rest of the dishes that we'll talk about tonight, but the influence of French and Chinese or other colonial powers on like the development of certain dishes, pho, for example. I know in our first episode about pho, we kind of referenced it. It's true beginnings, quote unquote true beginnings, to be French influence. But I think, Benny, you got a different take on this, right?
Yeah, you know, what's interesting is I think we guys talked a little bit about the origins of it. Pot de pho is basically the hot pot in the fire. But I've heard the other side of the argument too. I mean, Chinese, that's based on the Chinese cuisine. And if you go across the border from Vietnam, you see similar dishes. And so it's up for debate. I know that there's a lot of word. There's an eight volume series that is in the archives. And I believe someone recently extracted it to look at it, which talks about the history of food in Vietnam. So, yeah, I think it's a big debate. But the other side of the debate is they actually came from China, but not based on the French.
So can you tell me more about that? I mean, from my perspective, it's always the interesting question is why was a certain dish chosen and by who, right? And so when you said that pho was quote-unquote chosen to be the national dish of Vietnam, but there are very similar dishes in neighboring areas, why was pho chosen in Vietnam but not those similar dishes in other regions chosen as the respected national dish?
Well, it's not the same in other regions. And then two, the taste of a country is different as well. So pho, wherever it originally came from, was slowly evolved in Vietnam to become what it is now.
From north to south, you mean? North of country to south?
No, it's just, let's just say hypothetically that it did come from China and then it made its way to Vietnam. Then that original idea of the dish, maybe there's no spices in it, maybe there's no herbs in it, and then slowly Vietnamese people start adapting their taste to it. And then when you have this dish, national dishes are really like a democratic decision. The country, the people decide whether it's good or not based on sales. There's no deciding these things. The country likes it, so they eat it. And the community decides whether or not a dish is great.
Run a restaurant and you learn pretty quick. The sound of a crisp fry starts way before the first bite. As delivery and to-go keeps business booming,
order for pickup.
McCain's SureCrisp fries keep orders crispy.
Hey, delivery.
After the trip, the crispiness comes through.
Mmm.
McCain's SureCrisp fries. Go the distance. See how far our fries can take your business at surecrisp.com/delivery.
It's finally here. Stop into Menards for amazing Black Friday deals. A 54-inch Giant snow tube is only $9.99 each. Ladies' slippers are just $6.99 a pair. And a men's heated jacket is $49.99. Ah, there's so many great Black Friday deals. I can't list them all. You'll have to hurry to Menards while supplies last to get these and many more Black Friday deals. Sale good Black Friday through December 1st. See Menards.com for details.
Save big money at Menards.
Well, it's a declaration of what the identity of a country is, right? And that pad thai is pretty common, but why do they pick pad thai versus pad?
But who's they people had tied of a government? Did the people pick with their pocket?
The people decide, the culture decides what's the dish. That's why in England, it's butter chicken, because the culture has decided this is what we like.
So when you say culture, are you saying like our pocketbooks are deciding that?
Sure. Yeah, it's what the community decides that they like.
Are you saying that pad thai is the Taiwan?
It's tum yum, isn't it?
Well, I think that conversation is hard, right? Because there's one where it's designated to be the national dish.
Yeah,
and
pad thai is tum yum fishing definition,
right?
To put some sort of hours.
Well, that's I mean, that's the other thing, right? It's there's a reason why the national countries pick this dish. As you can see, it's all power, a reflection of their identity, or a way to show what their culture is, right? So that, I think that's going down that path of defining national dish. I don't know the answer, but it's hard because I think there's national designated ones that could be dictated by the tourism board or the national government or whatever, or it could be just an adopted one. We just don't know that particular answer or criteria. And I think it will vary per country, right?
Yeah. So in some books, pad thai is a relatively recent kind of invention.
Yeah.
And then it was pushed by the Thai government to have to be there as an essential soft power to the rest of the world.
Especially in the U.S.
Yeah, especially.
The Thai government has a lot to do with pushing Thai cuisine.
Thai restaurant. Yeah. And it's interesting, too. You see the kind of the emergence of sushi and Japanese cuisine in the early 80s.
Right.
There's Thai food in the 90s. There's a little bit of like a revolution of Vietnamese food becoming more common in America. And everyone knows it's pho, right? But then the new dish is bún bò Huế, and people are starting to discover a new cuisine here. That's only this perspective. But when you go to Vietnam, there's so many dishes. And I think one of the things I get irritated about is that everybody thinks that pho is the only noodle dish in Vietnamese cuisine. Well, there's over 30 different noodle dishes, even at least.
And there are at least so many great ones.
Yeah.
I mean, we're just talking deliciousness. That's a big debate.
I mean, we can even talk deliciousness and variety, right? Because I think Vietnam really takes the pride. I mean,
it's Vietnamese. On the way, I was like, yeah, it's Vietnamese, no contest.
Right. That's right, that too. But we're talking about Singapore, right? So he thinks it's laksa. We thought it's Hainan chicken. I thought it was a chili crab. So
yeah, the three top three.
Yeah, the designation. I don't know. It's hard to judge on, but you know, when you look at the beauty of it is Southeast Asia is such a phenomenal place because of the diversity of culture and food, and even you know when I lived in it, I didn't live in Indonesia, but I worked in Indonesia. The most amazing thing about Indonesia is the diversity of all the cultures, all the languages that is not Bahasa, because that was brought in by Suharto to make it easy for people to speak the same language. And that was on purpose to unite the archipelago of Indonesia. But all the foods are different. You're talking about Sumatra or Java, Muslim. And then in Bali, you have the famous, you know, barbecue pig that's there. That's very famous, too. So that's what I love about Southeast Asia and the diversity. It can highlight national dishes, but then look at how they pick it. Pad Thai is a common food on the street that everybody can eat, and it's easy to eat. And Hainan chicken is a little bit different, right? It's cooked a certain way, but it's cut from Hainan. But Singapore has a whole different history of independence founded by Chinese, and the and then all of a sudden we talk about the infusion of different cuisines in Southeast Asia. Look, all the curries came from the Indian migrants that came to Southeast Asia, right?
So many of the national dishes that we're going to talk about, are they rice and noodle based, and are they also pork and chicken based, or you know, where does beef come into it? Where does, you know, other ingredients apart from those four things come into it? Because, you know, if you think about lamsa, it's seafood, yes, but it's noodle, right?
Well, it's coconut based too, which I think the coconut milk makes it unique to Southeast Asia.
Well, the coconut is in Vietnam, right?
Yeah, but we don't like coconut. We don't use coconut milk much.
In the south, we do.
And a little bit less, but a little bit more than the north.
A lot more than the north. They don't use
it at all.
You know,
but you don't see it as penetrating the cuisine as much as you do in Malaysian cuisine or Thai cuisine.
Right, yeah, right.
And, you know, how are we going to get to all of this if we don't get into each of the dish? Because you said, well, we will, but
yeah.
Let's get into it. Let's get into
Thailand.
Thailand. Let's start with Thailand. It's green curry, pad thai, and tom yum. Those are the three most popular, and larb too, arguably. Is that?
I think green curry, pad thai, tom yum, and som tam.
Love is.
I don't know
what's so som tam. So, yeah, papaya green masala.
Papaya green masala. Yeah, and larb is Laos, but larb is also. I mean, I always have the larb at a Thai restaurant. For me,
yeah,
I always have to have larb.
But I think here's the thing that we can speak to a little bit later, but it's this this artificial construct of national borders,
yeah,
right? Whereas Southeast Asia, a lot of it is archipelagos, islands, and that means a lot of sea travel and sea transport through the ages. And I think that lends itself to very rapid changes and an exchange of flavors and dishes and things like that. So like I said, I think mainly for me, you're looking at the dishes, the commonalities are like rice or noodles and, you know, pork or chicken typically, right? Because all four of those things are very common to many of the Southeast Asian countries.
Yeah, I mean, look, I think, well, from a human perspective on what's easy to grow and raise, it's really chicken and the pork, right? And when you go to the Muslim countries, they don't have pork, but if we talk about, you know, keeping kosher or halal, and those are religious reasons, but at the end of the day, they have origins in public health reasons. And so if you start from there, I'm not sure. But yes, it's rice-based. And we're a rice-based society, and most of Southeast Asia is. Then you add on the other things. Like beef rendang in Malaysia is huge.
Yep.
Right? Coconut milk. The coconut milk. And yep. Nasi lemak. And they're heavy in the curries and heavy in the coconut milk, which is pretty interesting. But I'm not sure if anything is based on anything, but then it's... I think it might have been derived.
And if we're talking about Thailand, it's also a very regional thing. Like they'll eat more larb in the north, you know, they'll have more pad thai than black in Bangkok. So it's hard to say.
So northern Thai is different. Southern Thai is different. Southern Thai is super spicy. Northern Thai, when you go to Chiang Mai, you have tau soy.
Yep.
It's very popular there. And this should, the Isan is the sausages. Larb, they know if they're larb. So even if... Yeah.
Very sort of spicy.
Matt, as you guys are all talking about this stuff, I'm thinking about like the average American, the taste buds, the palate of an average American. This is like 90% like missing in the American palate. You know what I mean?
There's much less nuance because, you know, they only take like whatever makes it the pad thai out of Thailand and make it here. Like they were just barely understanding regional parts of Italy, let alone
sure Southeast Asia.
Yeah.
But let's anchor this conversation in kind of the taste in Southeast Asia, right? I think Philippines is a little bit different. Vietnam is also a little bit different. But if we think about Thailand, Malaysia,
Singapore.
I mean, Singapore is based more Chinese cuisine.
Indonesia.
You're talking about the balance of sweet with savory and sour. They're less sour in Malaysia and Indonesia. Thailand is just a trifecta of sour, sweet, and savory.
You know.
And that's why you have sugar in your pad thai, right? And then you squeeze a lemon on top, then you have your noodles, and then your seafood, your chicken, whatever your options are. And I think that's pretty interesting because Vietnam is a base on that. It's kind of healthier, and then it's kind of based Chinese cuisine, but it's kind of on its own island. And the Philippines is a whole different world where you're seasick, you have your lechon, and then you have your, it's pretty heavy.
Mm, very soy sauce, yeah. And Malaysian food and Indonesian food is very similar, where it's also very heavy. Palm oil is used a lot in their cooking, so you feel that a lot too. And that's probably because it's affordable, available, and grown a lot in Southeast Asia, in those two countries. But I don't know. That's a suggestion to start there, because if you look at the palates, they're very different, you know? And then that's why I'm dying to bring some of that cuisine to Mexico, because they kind of are similar to the sour, sweet, and savory.
Yeah, I mean,
you Mexico is regular. It's different combination.
So nice speed. It is a heap of the, how do you put the wine down?
Mexicans and Vietnamese food are so similar. And that's why when you go to a pho restaurant, you see so many Mexicans there.
You do.
Yeah.
You do?
Because we really love flavorful, like clear pots with no dairy in it. So it's not heavy at all. They like a lot of spices, and they like a lot of freshness. You know, they put raw onions and cilantro on their tacos. We like tearing like Thai basil on our pho. Like, there's a lot of similarities that I think when we eat each other's food.
But that garnish, that in pho, it's cilantro and onion. It's the same garnish.
You ready to get your mind blown? You know menudo?
Yeah.
So you take menudo and bubahoy, and you take the hominy out of the menudo and the innards, and then you put lemongrass into it, you get something pretty close. How about that?
I've done something like that before. I did a...
Are we going off topic again?
No, just know you're saying us. Yeah, I just think Mexico and Southeast Asia make a lot of sense.
It's about like is it umami flavor? That's very, I wouldn't say particular to Southeast Asia, but it's very prevalent in Southeast Asian cuisine.
Yeah, well, we like the biggest forms of umami are going to be from fish sauce, obviously, and mushrooms. Mushrooms, and then funk from fermented fish or like a shrimp paste.
Did you call it funk?
Yeah, funk.
What?
Yeah, it's a. You mean like fish sauce is like funk in it, but then there's like shrimp paste is gonna be even funkier.
When you said funk,
like,
I out.
Like my
when you said funk, well,
damn.
In a way, but I was like, bro, never.
And then of course we need soy sauce too. So these are the big.
Yeah, this happens, umami. You know that fish sauce flavor profile match with the Mexican cuisine you were talking about.
I think Mexicans do not have funk anywhere near their stuff.
Yeah, they don't have funk, but they do. I mean, a lot of things have umami in it. Tomatoes have umami. Meat has umami in it.
So that's why.
Yeah, but it's not a funk.
Mexican originated. Vietnamese food. Is that what you're saying?
Is that what attracts Mexicans to be?
No, I think we were talking about cilantro.
No, not the umami.
Not the umami, not the funk, because there's no funk in Vietnam.
Yeah, that's what I was surprised. Like,
Yeah. I don't know if I would give a bumang to a Mexican.
Yeah, they do want to go
there. Yeah, but this idea of funk, I'm almost 50 years old, and this is the first time somebody has
articulated.
Not even the funk. Vietnam's not even the funkiest. I think Cambodia is more funky than Vietnam, even. Yeah.
Yeah, from the ferment,
but came up with that.
But from the fermented aspect of it, if you think about sambal, right? Sambal is chili with shrimp paste.
Is it
sambal? Yes.
In the
sambal
depends who's making it, but
yes, our sambal is the one that's made by Sriracha, which is kind of purely chili case. But you look at sambal from in Malaysia and Indonesia, it all has shrimp paste, different forms. Some are baked, some are cooked, and some are not, but that's what sambal is.
Right? It might look like XO to other people.
Exactly. Or the chili crunch, right? Chili crunch, chili oil, whatever you want to call it, a lot of it has the dried shrimp in it in Southeast Asia. And that's the difference between that in China. And so there's a lot of anchoring in seafood in Southeast Asia, and the usage of fish sauce is pretty prevalent. So I mean, fish sauce was used in ancient Italy too, and there's a couple dishes now, but it is an anchor for all the dishes in Southeast Asia. I think that's a pretty good and interesting, well, in an aspect of...
You know, when I'm hearing all of you talk about Southeast Asian food now, I'm thinking about funk is what really defines it. There's no funk in Japanese and Korean food. There's no funk.
There's not much funk in Chinese.
There's less funk.
There's less funk.
Well, I mean, Japanese, there's no funk. The Japanese is yuzu, right?
And so it's like, so yuzu is not funk. Yuzu is like a
clean ass. I eat a fermented squid. Yo, that's funk. That's a 10 out of 10 funk.
Jagun?
Good stuff. Yeah, that's really good.
And it's not the funk that we, it's like that dirty funk.
It's the same.
Really? What is it called?
A dirty funk? That's not dirty.
Like, I like the dirty. It's a siffle.
for Caucasian tree.
Dude. Right. Yeah.
You gotta decolonize your mind, bro.
Yeah, like, just like, hey, we gotta just reclaimed Dernies.
So okay, I just put an asterisk for later episode, but fish sauce arguably came from Roman times.
Yeah.
So there'll be a separate episode.
We will do one.
Or they should have figured out themselves differently. They just, I think, with lack of a better term, non-Asian or white people don't realize that that actually plays some sort of role in Thai cuisine. Don't forget about this, right?
Yeah.
It's so, funk. And what is on the, it just doesn't show up that often. They use a fatty more garum and they just don't use it that often.
Yeah.
Their main kumami in Italy is like cheese, Parmesan, super high umami.
And a truffle.
That was less umami.
Less umami, right?
Yeah.
So, no, but I think that's the beauty of, yeah, I mean, if you look at things that are fermented, there's a lot of fermentation.
Yeah.
That happens in Southeast Asia, the fermented seafood and tofu.
Why is that, given that it's tropics weather, right? Why is there so much fermentation when there's, because it's tropical, there's so much fresh.
I think there's a culture of fermentation all over the world, right?
Yep.
Yeah.
At some point, you as a
product,
you have to.
Human.
Yep. Well, it's pickling and fermentation.
Yeah, you had to say that it can cure.
Yeah, so
that keeps it alive.
It's, you know,
well, no, I mean, the thing is, you know, so back in the day, what is it, Vietnam, talking to a historian, to be unnamed, you know, some of the main drivers in during the war was drugs, prostitution, and salt. And why was salt so important? It was, how do you preserve food when you're in the jungle? And food spoils quickly.
No refrigeration.
No refrigeration.
No, if you're going to get, yeah.
And that's what's soon. Look, I mean, I spent some time in Europe and people pickle stuff, right? People do sausage and salami. It is no different than Southeast Asia. In fact, I think in Southeast Asia, food spoils faster.
Obviously.
Right.
So, yeah, that's a big...
So salting stuff and fermenting stuff preserves everything else. Yeah, it's sort of the basis of a lot of the food that's there too.
So how come fish sauce and that type of very strong umami flavor didn't catch on in Europe, for example?
It was there. It arguably started in Italy.
Yeah, because some of the spaghetti and pasta dishes have a little bit of funk. It's very subtle.
Well,
but yeah, there.
Well, there's
cheese is very
strong about life. But Targa has a bit of funk to it. Or you're talking about anchovies got some funk to it.
There we go.
Yeah, anchovies then. All right.
Yeah.
But you know. But what's interesting is how they use that to incorporate it into the food. Like Vietnamese cuisine and a lot of other Southeast Asian cuisines, it's also condiment based, right? And a lot of it's based on fermented tofu, fermented soybean, and they combine those tastes. So it's a funk with the other funk, right?
Yeah.
Which is like, how do you eat seafood with more shrimp paste? But it's funk on funk, but it's delicious. And I think that's the beauty of the complexity of taste.
Yeah.
Because that's what you mean, right? We go to some place where it's like so normal, where it's just basic food, but the complexity, look, I spent all this time in Switzerland and Germany, schnitzel, bratwurst.
Zero funk.
Sauerkraut. Mustard is the base, and that maybe is a little funk they add, but look how complex all these dishes in Southeast Asia are. I don't know about the cooking part compared to other cuisines, but the combination of flavors all worked. I mean, halo halo in the Philippines is probably like a combination of random delicious things and a dessert. But if you look at the dishes, right, it's pretty complex. It's very complex, you know?
It's not easy to do. Actually, one of the most difficult things to learn, I think, cooking-wise globally, is learning how to season things in Southeast Asia. Like learning how to make a very good sumtum or papaya salad, seasoning it is the hardest part. Seasoning your bumbo whey with your palate is the harder part.
It's hard. Tell me more about that. Like, what would you, as a chef, how do you season it and what do you look for as markers of good seasoning?
Let's talk about Europe first. Europe, normally seasoning is like a simple tequila. Either vinegar or lemon juice is your seasoning, and then you got salt and then that's it, and everything else is flavor, right? And then in Asia, let's just say we're seasoning ganjuo like maybe sour soup, you know, you start with tomatoes, which has acid in it, you got tamarind, which has acid in it, you got enough fish sauce, you got pineapple, you have maybe you're adding bouillon or something like that, So there's a lot of like things that add to the seasoning, and you have to learn how to balance all that. It's very, very challenging. And then balancing the amount of umami as well. There's many more things that you have to control when you're seasoning Asian food.
Yeah, especially soups.
Yeah.
Soup. Well, was that balance of like finding that ripe umami versus the acidity, all of it like absorbs together. And then even like the bone broth that comes from like a pork braga that has all that other stuff in it. There was like, it's hard.
Yep.
Because you have like water evaporating and it becomes its own thing.
Are you talking about all the paste that the Thais make, their curry paste or their like chili paste? It's a really, really difficult thing. It's like mole
consistent.
Mole in Mexico. It's like you're just balancing a lot of things at once. In Europe, you know, pasta is very straightforward. You know, it's flour, it's egg, maybe a little bit of milk or oil or something like that. Then you got ricotta, also very straightforward. It's not super, super complicated to manage the taste of it. It's not that it's not easy, but in terms of seasoning, it's much easier.
Interesting. I mean, like Indian food also is very complex, right?
Indian food, very, very difficult to do.
This is your managing oil.
Yeah.
Try making curry powder because it's a mixture of a bunch of things. Like, yeah. Like, it would be very, very difficult to do.
Yeah.
These are things we don't think about.
Yeah. I mean, I think, yeah. But I mean, I have the pleasure to travel so much to learn about it. And that's where a lot of Southeast Asian cuisine comes from, the Indian influence, right? For all the traders at the time.
Yep.
And it's pretty incredible, man. I wouldn't even dare try to make Indian curries nor Thai curries. Oh, you want to make it by hand? I mean, it is a lot of labor going on, I think, to combine the flavors and make it all white.
Yep. Real.
You know, I'm always worried about like the world losing its variety, whether it's in cultural sort of norms, cultural practices, and food practices. But it sounds like there's just so much variation that if it all comes together and becomes one, it that's like thousands of years away, right?
Can we talk, with that, can we talk about vibrancy of the food scene and like the innovation in the food scene in Southeast Asia versus maybe other continents? And how does that fit into this, I think, move globally towards fusion food, like what Ken's referencing?
Yeah, and I think I was going to get to, it's all about the night markets, right? A lot has to do with the night markets, because in the night markets, you can change and shift very quickly.
Well, there's a lot.
You can
sell at
street food.
I think street food also, like, especially...
Same thing for me, yeah.
We're talking about metropolitan, especially we're from a big cities like Saigon and Bangkok, you're going to see the most innovation.
Yeah.
Because you're seeing the most cultures mixing together, you're going to see the most people, and also the most competition. So people are going to have to differentiate themselves. And you see, like, I don't know, like pho chom and stuff like that. That's a brand new dish. Just because they just need to... They're different.
I don't know if you see it.
You know, that's a very interesting comment. You go to Mexico City, right?
Yep.
You don't have a lot of street food.
No, you do not want
to. You have to go find it to the taco place that has this. But when you go to, and this is an Asian thing, I think, right? In terms of how it's set up, the competition, the concentration of people in markets and wet markets, right? Because traditionally, wet markets were had the mini food court next door to it where they were had access to that. I think it's different. Even in Taiwan, I had durian with cheese, and it was shredded American cheese, like the cheddar and the
durian.
You let me just tell you,
I heard cheese and durian are pretty good.
It is the most delicious thing I ever had, but I think that's the culture, that whether it be Asian culture, whatever culture it is, it's kind of part of the culture in Southeast Asia where you have street food, you know. But they have to innovate. I mean, in Vietnam itself, and we talk a lot about what happens here and what is real Vietnamese food, they're innovating in their origin countries all the freaking time, you know? Like you talk about the pho chol, right? Have you ever had, it's like, I call it the Vietnamese taco, right? You have banchan, yeah. They grow the banchan and they put minced pork that's cooked in lemongrass. That was a new thing that popped up when I lived there. I was like, what is this? And I was like, yeah, we just created this. Using rock salt to dip in your seafood as opposed to just regular salt. Now, these are innovations that are happening there because I think the public also demands it.
Yeah. They want to eat well. They want to eat things.
What was that from dip?
One thing I discovered is pho kun, right?
Yeah, but that's common for a while though.
No, here in America we don't have that.
I've seen fugu for a while now.
But here in the US?
Yeah.
Yeah. Whoa, really?
Everyone and for sure they're doing it in like San Francisco at least.
I don't see a lot by Orange County.
That might be a political thing because it's in the north. It's a northern dish.
It's a northern dish and it's been around for 40 years.
It's been there forever.
Yeah, because the last time I was back there in May, they were like,
yeah.
We've been having this little district, a Falkong district, for 40 years.
Give me a light. I'm sorry. I'm from Hanoi.
It's common.
Yeah. She probably just doesn't connect with our community. We just don't like it.
Well, they also may not be exposed to it, right? This, yeah. I mean, talking about the history of food in Vietnam, you know, you're talking about the reform, the land reforms that happened, the starvation that happened in the north, or officially just a dark period. Actually, the cuisine in Hanoi changed. Think about this, right? You're talking about the changes that happened, the government, everything. And they went through a period of starvation, went through a period of tough times where they had to use stamps. They actually, I don't know if you heard about this, but it's called wooden fish.
Yeah, I've heard it.
Right? And then it was a time where they took wooden fish to pretend it was fish and dip it in fish sauce. And even the evolution of food in the north was different from the south.
I think Professor Lin Han talked to me about wooden fish, I think.
Yeah.
Somebody you know, yes, pretty well.
Yeah. But it's a common thing with people who survive. Remember that time where it was based on stamps where you actually collect your square piece of meat every week. And so there's an evolution, I think, when we talk about as Vietnamese Americans or Asian Americans, there's things happening over there that's, I think, innovation is moving faster because of competition, because people demand food, people love food, and it's happening. I mean, there are new dishes all the time in Vietnam. And so when we're talking about Orange County, blah, 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 it's moving fast as hell there.
Yeah. You know, one food that doesn't get, or one group for me is Cambodian and Laotian. Like in America, we don't get to see and hear too much of that. You hear, and worldwide, I think we hear Singaporean, Thai, Vietnamese food. Oh,
it's not much of a Singaporean food in LA, for example.
Right, immigration.
Yeah,
but Asian pans. But internationally, we hear a lot about Singaporean food.
But you don't hear a lot about Cambodian food.
But it's good food. It's really good food.
Yeah, that's what we got Hoot Tieu from.
So go ahead, tell me more about that.
Oh yeah, there's a dish from Cambodia. I forget the name. K-U-Y-T-E-A-V, I think. Yeah, that's where Hoot Tieu originated.
Yeah. People forget about that.
Really, yep. Really similar dish.
Yeah. It's just like Vietnamese comes from, it's more related to Khmer than they did the Chinese.
Absolutely.
But yeah, that dish is, it's interesting because I'm not a big Hoot Tieu fan. A lot of people love it. It's just not my thing. But
I might have also not had a good one. There's so much variety. There's like a different quality.
Yeah. No, I've had it there. I don't know.
That's probably my one of my favorite.
Isn't it?
Yeah,
it's a lot of people's favorite.
If I had a choice between Hoot Tieu and Pho and Bún Bò Huế, I would pick Hoot Tieu. A good bowl of Hoot Tieu anytime. And then it has that the bone broth, the pork bone broth.
Yeah,
dude, it's
all day we tell number one.
It is. It's true.
Yeah,
it's true.
By people,
Hoot Tieu is for me. I don't. It's so complex. And I know it comes from the Cambodian Ilnan.
A lot of people, though, I understand when people prefer Bún Bò Huế. I understand when people prefer Pho. I even understand when people prefer Bánh Canh Cua. Man, it's all really good.
Yeah.
Bún Riêu. I mean, we have some bangers.
We have a banger. Some bangers.
Yeah, dude. It's like Thriller. It's only hits.
Hello. Lê Quán, right?
Lê Quán.
But
let's see, why don't we go back to Vietnamese cuisine?
But, I mean, we're just... I know, so... You know, it's interesting, and look, I might violate some and offend some people, but the variety, the people don't recognize a variety of Vietnamese cuisines, and there's very few places where you find that kind of variety.
But we cannot be the Southeast Asian podcast if we're just harping on Vietnamese.
Well, let's talk about other dishes.
Let's
talk about other dishes that we really love in Southeast Asia. Hainan chicken.
That's the reason I wanted to say that.
Oh, reason there.
Hainan, that's delicious. From Hainan.
Ever.
Is it? But is it?
But it's popularized in single Singapore.
It's popularized everywhere. Oh, even in Vietnam.
But is it a Hainan thing?
Well, when we think Hainan chicken, we're thinking the version that they eat in
Singapore.
Yeah. And then laksa is gaining popularity in Southeast Asia too.
This guy, this is It's all about lobster for me. Do you like lobster?
I think I've been in the U.S. for 20 years, right? I've been searching for good lobster for 20 years.
Hard to find.
If you try to find lobster. Yeah. And when I do, really, like, it's not that great.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Singaporean cuisine is I mean, if you look at it, right, how much of it was sort of not just Chinese origin, is basically Chinese dishes, and what is actually specifically Singaporean. And so that's also a complex, and Singaporeans will probably kill me, but laksa is specific. It's a Malaysian dish, not Singaporean dish.
Right?
Wait, there's no debating that, right?
Well, the origins are from Malaysia.
But if, you know, the question becomes, what is Singapore, or who is Singapore, right?
Well, of course, Malay, right? Originally, we're talking
about that path.
Yeah. Singapore is like an artificial construct.
So I wouldn't say that either.
The same. But it's all of it. I think it's none of it, and it's all of it.
There's a little bit cross national borders and how artificial and arbitrary they are.
Yeah.
Right.
Look, I think Singapore is interesting in itself in terms of where it's come today. I mean, obviously, it's a development success story. It's a city.
It's a distinct entity now.
It's a city state. They have been very successful. Singapore is the best passport the whole in the world. And to be fair to them, it's been an incredible story. I mean, when you talk about economic development, people don't like to use that as a comparison because it's a city state and the way that they govern that city state. But to give them credit, yes, there are very specific things like chili crab. Right, I think a very specific.
That's very Singaporean, right?
Yeah,
yeah. It's like, but the crab Hong Kong. That's not Thailand.
But the crab do come from Sri Lanka, you know. No, but it's very distinct to Singapore. So there's Singaporean cuisine.
Yeah,
I would say how much of it is indigenous to Singapore versus Chinese cuisine? But so when you go to Singapore, you go to I forgot what they call it, not the food markets, but
hawkers.
The hawker stands, right? I mean, a lot of them are based on Chinese cuisine.
I mean, all roads lead to China. I mean,
yeah, to be honest here.
Well,
it's got a noodle in it. We're roasting pork.
Well, look,
there's seen garlic.
Southeast Asia has, I mean, the role of the Chinese in Southeast Asia has been tremendous from an economic standpoint, obviously, but also from a food standpoint. And so when you look at District 5 in Vietnam, that's all Chinese. This is the integration of Chinese in each of these countries are different.
And so what demarcates a dish, you know, from, you know, Chinese versus being Vietnamese or Chinese versus Singaporean? What makes it national to a certain
time? I think time, you brought that up earlier. How long has it been known as their national dish? It's time.
I would argue that it also depends on how you, the integration. We want to talk about integration of Chinese in the different countries in Southeast Asia. You know, that's a different experience. And when you look at the cuisine, I think it's similar, right? Is it a big issue in Indonesia versus Chinese? And there was a 1997 revolution, the mobile phone revolution is a very distinct cut between Chinese versus Indonesia. When you look at Vietnam, right, District 5, there's a lot of integration. Obviously, Vietnam is closer to Chinese culture.
District 5 foods.
Yeah, but they distinctly look wonton noodle soup and wontons are that's Chinese.
Yep,
right. But when you look at Thailand, the integration of Chinese into Thai society is like almost indistinctive right now in a sense, right? But you look at the food, there's a distinction. Wonton noodle soup is Chinese, and then when you go to the streets of Saigon, they had the little stand with the Chinese mirror writing on it. You know, it's wonton soup. So the question is, what other dishes that have been purely fusion between the two?
Indigenous.
Yeah. So I don't even know if it needs to be indigenous. You can just take a dish from, like, I don't know, Hainan chicken again for you.
Well, it's like, it's not from there, but they've like learned to love the dish.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of become theirs.
So it's Hainan chicken in Singapore, wherever, different from Hainan chicken
in Indonesia.
Yeah, I don't think they use the same dipping sauces.
Yeah.
There's like a dark sweet soy in Singapore, then use
the garlic, ginger-based one.
Ginger, scallion, mania, MSG.
Right. So we talked about innovation, right? in Southeast Asian food happening a lot, where there's a lot of street food, hawkers, all things like that, because of competition, essentially. Tell me more about how we think Southeast Asian cuisine will grow and develop in Western countries like the US, Australia, UK, Germany, where how does it go from food of the immigrant population to mainstream and then to basically high-level cuisine?
In the US,
how does that choose?
In the US or internationally?
Internationally,
US, international, like Western international mainstream, or are you talking about mainstream Southeast Asia?
Let's do both.
I think if we talk about the US market, I think it takes a long time, and I don't know if it's entirely possible to make something become like a hamburger or hot dog in America, right? Or pizza.
Hamburger's from Germany. Pizza's from
Italy. Here.
But in terms of popularity?
Yeah.
Pizza. I mean, I'll just make it.
But do you think pho will ever become an American staple? Like pizza?
People love pho in America. They love pho. They love tacos. They love pizza. They love, yeah.
Oh, it breaks down. Pho breaks down buried, man. But yeah, it's always, the Christmas do, 15, 20 years ago.
LA loves Thai food.
Yeah.
Dynaloo's tucks in.
But I would say our conversation is anchored in a little bit of what is the perspective of America. And I think the evolution or the presence of ethnic cuisine in America has its own pathway. But if you look at living in Southeast Asia, and now that they're developing very fast, they're now experimenting. You know, you guys talk about high cuisine, French cuisine, and we had this conversation here. Why is Chinese food perceived to be cheap? It's orange chicken and general sauce, right? And why can't there be high-end cuisine? But if you look at Southeast Asia, they're developing on their own right. They have their high-end Vietnamese cuisine. They have their high-end Thai cuisine that is kind of breaking that barrier of it's only cheap food. And that's kind of going on its own path, maybe an accelerated path, because they appreciate actually the complexity of how they've achieved high cuisine for the local cuisine. And then here, which I think we're stuck in the dark ages, people just to try to get out of the gate for pad thai. Then there's someone similar to you that I met that was a chef. He's broken out to have a Thai omakase charging $600 per se. And it's actually elevating Thai cuisine.
Omakase.
So, yeah, I mean, and this is when you...
How do you make the leap? Like, how do we make the leap from, that level to being omakase style? Is it fusion? Is it...
No, I mean, clearly Thai omakase
is going to be the chef's... creation. It's going to be the culture that's going to push things.
Is it just the food? Is it the ingredients? Is it the decor? What is it?
Well,
it's a level of detail.
It's an education and a narrative that you're going to...
And an intention, right?
Yeah.
You have big name chefs that, or even somebody like Anthony Bourdain. Hey, we trust Anthony Bourdain. Hey, this is really good. You guys should really eat.
Yeah.
But the thing that when I heard some of your podcasts about, Michelin stars and all that, but what's his name? And I'll say this, it's kind of framed within this colonialistic view of us being in America, right? But now the agency is given to chefs in the local countries to elevate it. And I think there's different ways to elevate it. Like Supanagat is a new restaurant in Thailand. It's farm to table. There's a difference between farm to table with other different kind of ingredients, but they've been able to elevate Thai cuisine at a different level, which is not according to French rules or Michelin rules or whatever.
Actually, do we require Michelin to be the imprimatur stamp of approval, or is it homegrown, kind of like, hey, this is intentional, this is high quality, etc., and it is what it is, and we don't need Michelin to come in and keep the standard for us.
Well, I think that's what I mean about what's happening in Southeast Asia, is they're figuring out how to elevate their own cuisine without, I mean, I think it'd be everyone wants this golden, get a high standard of Michelin putting a rating on it because it makes it more popular, but I don't know if this people innovating at a higher level of fine dining in Southeast Asia that is not trying to get a Michelin star. They're just trying to elevate cuisine.
Yeah, totally. But Michelin is the quickest way to get yourself
shortcut.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is fascinating. I hope that we can do a part two on this. And, you know, I don't know if we came out of this conversation agreeing. You know, let's go around the room. What is your top three dishes all around Southeast Asia?
Mm.
Top three.
Well, that's top three.
It's too hard.
That's very hard. Number one.
That's not, you do top three per country. That's even.
You know, see, that's hard. That's hard. Yeah. How about just one per
country? I think it's number one.
Per country?
Well, too much. Number one?
How about just top three in the whole region? Top three in the whole region.
For me, it's top three in the region. Wimbawe and Laksa. Sorry, that's my.
That's
good. Okay.
So one of my favorite dishes in Thailand is not found here. And it's based on wing bean. I don't know if you've heard of
wing bean.
So it looks like a Chinese cilantro, which is we use in pho, but actually has a harder core and they chop it. So it's called yam tuo pu. It's a wing bean salad. And what it is it just says firm shrimp paste a little bit and then mixed with some other sauce. They chop up the wing bean and they serve it with shredded chicken.
You know this dish?
I've heard about this dish, but I know you can get wing bean, but it's not easy to find.
It's not easy to find. That's why they don't have in here. And then you have boiled egg and they put that in there. It is one of these beautiful things I have, and I can't find it here. And when I go to Thailand, I always ask for it. And when I joke around with the Thai massage lady or at the grocery store, like they laugh because it's one of the best dishes in Thailand.
Wow.
You just can't find wing bean here.
Yep.
It's a beautiful balance between the fermentation. There's not much sour in it, but there's some sour from the sambal. They get the egg, it's shredded chicken, and the texture is incredible. That's one of my favorite dishes in Southeast Asia.
What's it called again?
Yam tuo pu.
Okay.
Yam is salad, tuo pu. I think it's based on.
Kill Thai accent.
Yeah. Fucking flexing.
Right? No, flexing.
Cool boys.
So it's a common part. That's it. No, but you try it. You
know,
but it's an incredible salad because they have, Thailand has so many salads, so it's all cold salad, blarb.
Yeah.
But yam tuo pu is one of them. It's incredible.
You know, I get excited about Thai food when I'm living in the States. And then when I went to Thailand for the first time, it was like, I was like, this might be the fucking best place in the world to eat.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm been to Japan yet, so yeah.
But I was really blown away by how good Thai food was.
Yeah.
And we're talking about Southeast Asia.
It was next level.
Yeah. Well, I was talking about the capitals of the world, right? But Bangkok is incredible, and I have some recommendations. I mean, there's Southern Thai food that will burn your whole body.
Yeah.
But there's one in the Tong Lof, Soi 5, that I'll introduce you to, which is amazing food. Stinky beans.
Yeah.
But extremely hot food. You know, yeah, I mean, you know, I had the luxury of traveling all throughout Southeast Asia, working in the different places and eating. And that, yeah, Thailand is, cuisine is pretty black.
Yeah.
Wait, there's a restaurant in Alhambra on Garfield and Main. I don't know if we've been to it. And it has a dish that has like a pineapple. It has like jicama. It has like peanuts.
Oh, it's at the Indonesian
place. It's at an Indonesian place. Yeah. What's the name of that dish?
Garo garo?
I don't know what it is.
Salad?
It's a salad.
Is it string beans? In it too as well?
Maybe
it's potato. Savory with fruit.
It's savory with fruit and it has funk in it.
Wait, it's close to that where your kids go to gymnastics.
Yeah. It's in the same street.
Yeah.
So that dish, it has carrots, it has.
Yes.
It, like, one of my favorite dishes in Indonesian. So good. I mean, that to me, they got to refine a little bit more, like cut up into smaller pieces.
Yeah, I should tell the chef.
All right, man. My favorite dish in all of Southeast Asia is tikkan. Tikkan is my favorite.
Okay.
Tikkan is my favorite dish.
Which is what?
Which is audience. Tikkan is a coagulated duck blood that's not cooked. And it's taken from duck blood and you boil duck meat in ginger and onion and you mince it up and then you put it spread out on the plate and then you pour duck blood on top of that with basil and
raw duck blood.
It's raw duck blood.
Yeah, pie or something.
Yeah. It looks like a pizza, but it's...
No, it's coagulated.
Coagulated.
What does Scottish call the sausage? Blood sausage, right?
Haggis.
So I guess, yeah, it's the same idea. So
what's raw?
Haggis is cooked.
Haggis is cooked, yeah. I can't think of anywhere else that eats raw.
I don't know anywhere in the world that makes takkan.
Thailand eats raw, but they only think.
But that's like, yeah. Let's talk. I just want to talk about texture for a second, right? And by the way, if you think about takkan, the texture, right? You've got the coagulated blood, you got the minced meat, you got the peanuts, you've got the
basil.
So there's a burst of flavors, but you know, one thing in Southeast Asia is there's a lot of texture.
Yeah.
And you're talking about the salad you talked about, right? You're talking about string beans, you're talking about carrots, you're talking about whatever it is, and peanuts. And I mean, my biggest texture dish that I've ever witnessed in my life in this cuisine is mee kuah. Think about...
Because it's in Asia, well, does it?
Yeah.
Mee kuah is yellow noodles, but it has so much dry.
Well, it's yellow and white, so there's already two textures. There were original one. You get...
It's turmeric if it's the yellow one.
Yeah. But you have both, which have different textures. You have the shrimp cracker. You have wild pork. Then you have roasted pork. Then you have...
Shrimp.
But the shrimp has shells in it.
Yep.
And I thought in my head, why the fuck would it have...
Shrimp.
Shell cells, but that was for texture. It has peanuts.
Your banana bok choy wheat?
No.
Yeah.
Your banana flour.
Yeah. No, the purple cone.
The flour. That's the flour.
Yeah, banana blossom. But I don't...
Bark banana blossom. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I don't think that was me. I don't think that made way.
No, well, we got...
That's the whole way, right?
Not in me.
No. Trust me. Mee kuan has it.
Okay.
It has it.
I don't remember.
I used to do the Hai Phong 1A in Da Nang. I don't remember.
In Orange County, Guanghe has it. It has it with jellyfish too.
Yeah. Oh yeah, no, I really like with jellyfish.
Yeah.
Right. Jellyfish is so
good.
It has
so good. You can get a regular bowl and then you can get the Supreme. The Supreme has the flour, the banana flour, and the jellyfish.
I like jellyfish.
But if you think about like, not just in Vietnam, right? The usage of the different ingredients available in the region is fresh vegetables, noodles, meats, roasted peanuts. And then the textures that you get is pretty complex. And then you find that in Thai cuisine, you find that in other cuisines. Fried onions is a big part of that too.
And
no one thinks about this, right? It's just like, I didn't realize that different kinds of pastas give you different tastes, depending on how you different shapes.
Yeah, right? Different shapes? Yeah, yeah.
Different shapes.
Yeah, when I was younger, I was like, that's all the same, dude.
Yeah.
No.
Wait. I'm literally now, like this, like a millisecond ago when you just said that, I was like, oh shit, I've never thought about that. But you are absolutely right.
Yeah, you had my pulse the other day.
I've never thought about that. But it's extraordinary. It never thought about that. You're right.
It's extraordinarily important because if you...
Subtle.
It's subtle, but when you... And it's also when you think about the Japanese and the Koreans, when they suck in their noodles, right?
Yeah.
It's a matter of how it hits when you allow air in. We don't do this in Vietnamese cuisine, but it's different.
I think it's very easy to understand. Imagine mac and cheese with spaghetti. We fucked up.
I think that's really the way to put it.
Yeah. You'll know.
You're right.
Yeah.
You're absolutely right.
And that's where you think about each different kind of noodle product, different each dish in Southeast Asia, it hits different. And that's why they particularly pick that. I mean, all these complexities are intentional. You know,
if you have any favorite dishes, please leave it in the comments. We would love to hear from you in the Southeast Asian podcast because we value diversity. We value diversity in dishes and we want to hear from you. And we would like to hear it in the comments.
Cheers
everybody.
Cheers. Cheers.
It's finally here. Stop into Menards for amazing Black Friday deals. A 54-inch giant snow tube is only $9.99 each. Ladies slippers are just $6.99 a pair. And a men's heated jacket is $49.99. Ah, there's so many great Black Friday deals. I can't list them all. You'll have to hurry to Menards while supplies last to get these and many more Black Friday deals. Sale good Black Friday through December 1st. See Menards.com for details. Save.